dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the most important and yet least understood elements of our success in the war for the free world is being able to deter aggression against us and to ensure victory should it come, which is determined in no small measure by an intangible thing that has come to be called the culture of our military. Few people understand that culture, certainly out of uniform, better than our first guest. Her name is Elaine Donnelly. She is the founder and president of a terrific organization, the Center for Military Readiness. She has been a spokesperson for protecting and strengthening and certainly respecting the culture of the United States military for decades. Elaine, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us.
Well, this is a good day to thank you for your efforts, because you're always alerting us to threats from potential adversaries such as China, Russia, North Korea, or Iran. We issued a news release today in reaction to the actions taken yesterday, and we asked a very important question. What message is the President and the Defense Secretary, Lloyd Austin, what message are they sending to these nations? They don't care about woke ideology, but this administration, this Pentagon, seems obsessed with woke ideology and diversity, as now they're calling it, an operational imperative. So the announcement that the reinstatement of the Obama-Biden transgender policies will take place in only 30 days, they'll come out with more details. They are reinstating a disastrous policy that occurred in the last 2 years of the Obama administration. There will be harmful effects. They keep saying this will show dignity and respect. Really, it is not a matter of respecting women to say that they have to share their private spaces in areas that have little or no privacy as it is with persons who are biological men. That is not showing respect for women. It is disrespectful to tell female athletes, and there's a lot of them at the service academies and all the military schools, that they have to play on teams with biological men. It is also not
or respectful. Against teams, I guess, as well.
Against teams, right. I mean, the whole idea that biological men should have access to women's sports. And in the military, you can be sure that because everybody must follow orders, it'll probably happen in the military even more than it already has in the civilian world. How does this benefit women at all? And talking about dignity and respect, what about our doctors and nurses, people who will be ordered to either do themselves or make sure that certain people who are confused about their gender identity, that they should get treatments that go only in one direction, not competent medical care that says, here are the risks, here are possible benefits, and let people decide. No, it's all one-sided, coordinated by outside LGBT activist groups.
Meaning in the direction of sexual changes surgically?
In many cases, irreversible hormone treatments, and of course, surgery is irreversible. The doctors and nurses who disagree, they're not going to have any option to disagree. It's either do what you're told or get out. So that's what we're facing. The Obama-Biden policies will harm our military. We know, because in those 2 years when they were in effect, we know that medical costs soared 300% for individuals diagnosed with gender dysphoria. That's a lot. 30,000 mental health visits for under 1,000 active duty service members. But the most tragic thing was the rates of suicide, 8 to 9 times the rate among other military members' suicide attempts. This is a problem that is tragic. We don't need to increase it in our military. But Secretary Austin doesn't care about that. He's only about woke ideology and diversity as a strategic imperative.
Right. Trumping military readiness, good order and discipline, morale, and the deterrent effect that in the absence of those things, our military is unlikely to have. This is really, I consider it, as I say, a wrecking operation against our armed forces, Elaine. And it comes again against the backdrop of a number of other steps that are being taken. You've mentioned diversity. There's a fellow who was charged with being the diversity director for the Special Operations Command, who seems to be all about trying to make sure that our best military units are no longer that because they've got the best people, the most fit, the most strong, the most courageous, the most capable, but their standards are going to be dumbed down to accommodate people simply because they have a different color or a different ethnicity or sex, for that matter, I guess. These are things that are going to have a very deleterious effect, are they not, on our armed forces?
They will. Special operations forces are, as advertised, very special. And the person who is selected to coordinate the implementation of their strategic plan has been reassigned because it was found out that he had put out some very attacking tweets against the former president of the United States. But it's much more than just this one person. We're in the process of analyzing the strategic plan for Special Operations Forces. It is one of the worst I've ever seen. It continues to say over and over again, diversity is an operational imperative, 12 times in 18 pages. It just keeps hammering away at it as if just by saying it over and over again, it makes it true. Well, it's not true. We need troops that have sound morale and mutual trust, prepared for whatever is ahead of them. Instead, we're going to have, and under this new transgender policy, we're going to have training programs, how to use the right pronouns, how to avoid offending the favored minority. The whole thing is all upside down priorities instead of military readiness being most important. It's all about social agendas.
Right. Elaine, let me just ask you this in closing. There's much more to talk about. We're just almost out of time. We have an all-volunteer force. The men and women who most exemplify the warrior spirit and capabilities, I fear, are unlikely to put up with all of this. Do you have reason to believe that we will see a mass migration, an exodus from the military of the people we most want to have be part of it, to assure, as they do, our security, the civilian population of the United States?
Well, I've gotten messages, and I'm sure you have too, from people who have just left. They're never asked why. There is no survey done to find out if people are dissatisfied with this. We know that recruiting and retention has been strong because of economic peril in the last year. That may erode in the future. We don't know. But the main thing is, what are our potential adversaries seeing when they look at our military? They see an obsession that has nothing to do with being prepared to deter or wage war. This is really serious. And our new president, Joseph Biden, seems unaware of everything that is happening, that the people in the Pentagon, these are Obama holdovers, by the way, that are coordinating this whole thing. And I'm sure that they enjoyed very much taking that red line, scratching out everything that President Trump did to reinstate what was done under the Obama administration. So, yes, they have gone full bore now to turn the military into more than a social experiment. This is a woke paradise, woke being, well, it's an extreme example of political correctness, taking it to extreme. And the Secretary of Defense, unfortunately, I think that this may have been why he was selected. This is his priority.
Almost certainly. He seems to have thrown himself into it with gusto. Lloyd Austin, that is, a former four-star general, commander of CENTCOM. Elaine Donnelly, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for the work you've long done at the Center for Military Readiness and are doing today. I hope you will come back to us with updates on this vitally important story often. Thank you so much. Next up, we'll speak with Senator Ted Cruz about, among other things, what's happening at our border right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest. He is Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, a brilliant litigator, a distinguished public servant, a former presidential candidate and best-selling author most recently of One Vote Away, How a Single Supreme Court Seat Can Change History, a book that was written, I think, before it was evident that applies equally to the United States Senate. Senator Cruz, it is terrific to have you with us. We've wanted to do this for a long time and are very grateful to you for joining us once again on Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome back, sir.
Well, Frank, it's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
I've got so much to talk with you about. I'm going to try to limit it to three topics in very quick order. Starting with your recent trip that you led a Senate delegation to see what I think of no longer as a border crisis, but now a man-caused border catastrophe, and that man would be Joe Biden. Your takeaway from your experiences there and what's coming next?
Well, as bad as you think it is, it's even worse. I've been down to the border many, many times over the last decade. I've never seen it remotely this bad. I brought a group of 19 senators to go down to the border last week. We arrived on Thursday evening. We joined the Border Patrol for their 10 p.m. muster, and we all took the chance just to say thank you to those agents who are risking their lives to keep us safe and who are feeling very unsupported by their political leadership right now. We then joined them on their midnight patrol. And we went out and saw just never-ending caravan of people walking on the trails, walking north from the Rio Grande up to the Border Patrol Processing Center. We saw children walking alone in some instances. We saw young mothers carrying infants and nursing the infants as they walked up the trails. The outdoor processing center was just a series of outdoor pens that had been roped off underneath an overpass of a bridge. There we saw hundreds of kids and moms just sitting on the floor outside waiting to be processed. The next day we went to where they go, which is the Donna facility. It is a gigantic tent city. It was constructed to hold 1,000 people, but with COVID restrictions, its capacity is 250. When we went there, there were 4,200 people in that facility, which is over 1,500 times its capacity. It is heartbreaking, and it is both a humanitarian crisis and a public health crisis, not to mention a national security crisis.
Is there any doubt in your mind that this is indeed the result of policies set in train by Joe Biden to reverse those of Donald Trump, first of all, but second of all, to create essentially open borders? And if that's the case, sir, why are they doing this?
Well, indisputably, this is a man-made crisis, and it was caused by Joe Biden. And in particular, three decisions that he made the very first week he was president. Number one, he announced that he was immediately halting construction of the border wall. And we saw sections of the border wall that had been built, but other portions that weren't finished, that they literally dropped their tools and left huge holes where illegal immigrants were streaming through them every night. We saw piles of rusted rebar just left on the ground because they halted everything and just left everything out to rust. Number two, Biden reinstated the failed catch and release policy. So now when they apprehend people here illegally, they give them a court date sometime in the future. They let them go. And everybody knows the vast majority of them are never coming back and never showing up to court. Number three, and this was the most inexplicable, they ended the Remain in Mexico international agreement. So in 2019, President Trump negotiated an agreement with the government of Mexico that immigrants coming from Central America and crossing illegally through Mexico would remain in Mexico while their U.S. asylum cases were pending. That decision resulted in last year the lowest rate of illegal immigration we have seen in 45 years. It was working spectacularly well. And in the first week of the administration, Joe Biden ripped that international agreement to shreds. And as a consequence, last month, in the month of February, we saw over 100,000 illegal immigrants crossing into this country, roughly 30,000 unaccompanied children. And this disaster was created by the political decisions of Joe Biden.
Yeah. And those are the people we know about. There are many more that got away. One of your constituents, terrific guy by the name of Todd Benzman, I'm sure you know from the Center for Immigration Studies, talks about not catch and release, but catch and bus, with people now being free transported into the heartland of America. So this is certainly not confined to your border state or any of the others for that matter. Senator, let me turn quickly
Frank, two points on that that I think are helpful for your listeners to understand, which is number one, how this is impacting national security. So we've got this massive influx of families, of young children, of unaccompanied minors. Now, those folks, it's not like we have to catch them. They go and look for Border Patrol agents. In fact, The administration has laid out these bright yellow signs pointing to where they go. So they're turning themselves in. But the consequence of this massive flow is roughly half of the Border Patrol agents are caring for these kids and caring for these families. You know, these guys signed up to defend the border and keep this country safe, and they're changing diapers. That means half the manpower is not out on the border. That is concerning, but the other group, and you made reference to it, are what they call the gotaways. And there's another group that they actively elude capture, and they are the narcotics traffickers. They are the violent criminals. They're the gang members. And because
human traffickers.
So much of the manpower, yes, so much of the manpower is devoted to the influx of people turning themselves in, there isn't the manpower to stop the gotaways. And the cartels know that. This is a big money-making endeavor. The second point you made is it's a really important thing to understand, which is, let's say an unaccompanied child, a little girl, a little boy arrives from Central America. They'll arrive with a phone number of some family member in the country. And the cartels are charging that family anywhere from $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, or $6,000. And, you know, you think 100,000 people, you're looking at $400-500 million a month the cartels are making. This is a big money-making endeavor. But once they cross the river, they have the phone number, and the U.S. government is the last part of the human trafficking network, because they hand them over to the U.S. government, and the U.S. government feeds them, clothes them, and flies them and delivers them to whatever family member they want. And so our government is actively part of this massive human smuggling operation where children are getting physically abused, sexually abused. It is inhumane.
And a national security threat.
And it's the opposite of compassion. The Democrats justify this as saying they're being compassionate. There's nothing compassionate about setting up a system where hundreds of thousands of children are physically abused and sexually abused by human traffickers. And that's what Joe Biden has done.
Right. And there is some question in at least some number of those cases as to who you're actually turning them over to. Are they family members, or are they simply part of the cartel operation in this country? Maybe turning them back to the other side of the border so that they can be used to get more people in the future. But Senator, let me turn quickly to...
And you're right. The cartels are renting children to single adult males, because the Biden policy is if you arrive with a kid, you can stay. So it used to be single adult males that crossed the border, roughly 2% of them would have a child with them. Now it's about 50%, because that child is essentially a get out of jail free card. And when they DNA test males with children, roughly 30% of them are not biologically related, but the cartels. And sometimes you see the same kid being rented over to multiple men to get them across the border, and then they're brought back and they do it again. It's horrific.
No, it is inhumane, as you say, Senator. Let me talk to you about at least one other topic, if I may. The election integrity issue is one that you've devoted a very considerable amount of time to, and I want to thank you for doing so, both in connection with the last election and trying to ensure that we have future elections that are reasonably free and fair. This is, of course, a concern in the Senate with this bill S1, also known as HR1 from the House. It is of concern because of steps that people in Georgia have finally taken to try to rectify some of the problems they saw in the last election cycle. And in both cases, we're watching this immense campaign being mounted to jam these pieces of legislation, in the case of HR1, through, and in the case of the Georgia bill, get it repealed. Could you talk a little bit about who's behind all of this and what is the actual object of this exercise? Is it election integrity or voter suppression of a different kind than we're constantly being told about, namely disenfranchising legal voters by having people who aren't entitled to vote cast ballots?
Well, you're exactly right, Frank. Let's take HR1 and S1 first. Pause for a second to reflect that those were the first bills introduced in the House and Senate. It's the number one priority of Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. And that priority is not COVID, it's not vaccinations, it's not getting people back to work, it's not getting kids back to school. The number one priority of the congressional Democrats and Joe Biden is locking in Democratic control of the federal government for the next 100 years. Many of us are calling HR1 the Corrupt Politicians Act, because it is designed to encourage voter fraud and to ensure that Democrats can never again lose a national election. How does it do that? Well, you take every bad idea from every left-wing radical group and they rolled it all into an 800-page bill. So, for example, it strikes down, it repeals virtually every state voter integrity law that's been passed. 29 states have voter identification laws, common sense laws that say if you're going to vote, you should have some identification. The Corrupt Politicians Act repeals every one of those, says it's illegal to require identification to vote. 31 states prohibit ballot harvesting. What is ballot harvesting? It is sending paid political operatives to collect ballots of other people's. They do things like they go to nursing homes and they'll collect hundreds of ballots, many from people not capable or competent of casting a vote. And the reason 31 states prohibit it is that it is particularly susceptible to fraud, that the harvester, if they see you vote the wrong way, they can just take your ballot and throw it away and only mail in the ones that vote the way they want them to. The Corrupt Politicians Act mandate ballot harvesting everywhere.
We are hard out of time, given your schedule. We would love to continue this conversation, and I'd hoped also to talk with you a little bit about what the Biden administration is up to with the Congress on this so-called domestic terrorism threat from white supremacists who look a lot like, well, I don't know, Trump supporters. But that's for another day. I hope it'll be soon. Thank you very much for your time on this occasion, and I appreciate so much your public service, sir, that you will continue to speak as candidly to the American people as you have with us today. It's vitally needed, God knows. Thank you.
You have my word on it, and thank you, Frank.
Next up, we'll speak with author Stephen Sukup about the woke capital corporate tyranny that is threatening our republic. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm pleased to say we're joined by a man who I have come to know recently, both in his writing and through his political activism, on a matter that I believe requires all of our attention. It is what he calls woke capitalism, and it is a shorthand way of describing what I think of as the weaponization of our capitalist system against our country. His name is Stephen Sukup. His new book is Dictatorship of Woke Capital, How Political Correctness Captured American Business. He is the prime mover behind a terrific outfit, The Political Forum, and always a welcome guest here. Steve, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to join us today to talk, among other things, about a new initiative that you are helping spearhead, a website called StopCorporateTyranny.org. First of all, set the stage for what corporate tyranny is taking place at the moment, and then we'll launch into what the importance of this website is.
Well, corporate tyranny refers to the growing trend of corporate America, its leaders and its funders, for advancing political causes in large part without regard for shareholders or customers, and also without much regard for the American tradition of self-governance. The general idea behind this is that woke capital, which I've defined in my book as a top-down anti-democratic strategy being employed by American business to change the way business functions, to change the definition of capitalism, and to change the relationship of the citizen to the state, is becoming a much more significant issue in the political realm. These woke corporate entities, these woke capitalists are beginning to flex their muscle a little bit more and trying to influence various policy debates much more aggressively and much more assertively than they had in the past.
I'm afraid it's not a little bit more. It seems as though it's a lot a bit more. And this is really why your book is so timely. And I think this website is as well, Steve. And let me just ask you, your subtitle, it seems to me, is understating the magnitude of what we're up against here. It's not just that these outfits are seeking to, you know, trim sail to become a little bit better aligned with the you know, political correctness of the day. It's that they, it seems to me, they're being taken over, really, by the radical left. And it's part of what I would describe as kind of the long march through the institutions, as the Marxists have called it, now reaching the corporate boardroom space. Would you disagree with that characterization?
No, actually, I would agree wholeheartedly. The first half of my book, The Dictatorship of Woke Capital, discusses the history behind the ideas that are now animating the corporate world today. And among other things is a fairly brief but nevertheless detailed explanation for why the Marxists undertook the long march through the institutions and how they did so and what the effects of that long march have been. Almost immediately, the post-World War I Marxists were able to take over a lot of the, a great many of the institutions of cultural transmission in the West, namely education, but also mainstream religion, entertainment, media, etc. It was only...
And even the political system to a considerable degree.
Correct. And it was only a matter of time, given that they had all of these, and especially higher education, before it became an issue in American business as well. If you control the means by which you teach future businessmen, then you also tend to have a significant amount of control over what these businessmen believe and what they enact as the capitalists of the day.
No, you know, it's interesting, Steve, you say that. One of our contributors here at Secure Freedom Radio is Jeff Nyquist, a brilliant sort of strategic thinker and essayist, who describes his experience, I think it was at Berkeley back in the day, and being told that, you know, with the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Marxists were now essentially out of business everywhere except in academia. And he, understanding, you know, what Marxists are about, said, this is disastrous. This is not something we should take any comfort from. And what you've just said is proof positive of how this inevitably translates into a problem. That I think we were on a call the other day where we talked about how these corporate boardrooms, the woke capitalists in them, are now jumping to the demands of the most radical of their employees in many cases. So quite apart from their own thinking or their own predilections, and those are problematic in many cases now, unfortunately, as well, there's this demand, not so much top-down, but bottom-up in many of these corporations happening as well. Is that your assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. The problem that we face in raising awareness about this issue, and the reason that we've started the website stopcorporatetyranny.org, is that this coalition, what we call the Back to Neutral Coalition, is keenly aware that most people who look at woke capital, see it exclusively as a top-down phenomenon. They see Tim Cook, they see Jeff Bezos, and they say, well, you know what, it's these woke CEOs enacting their policies. But that's only a part of the problem. As you say, there's a great deal of pressure coming from the bottom up, and there's a great deal of pressure coming from the outside in, from activist shareholders, from activist asset managers. This is a multifaceted problem.
So-called stakeholders, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And this is a point we talked about yesterday with Dan Celia as well, that this morphing, as you've described in your book, The Dictatorship of Woke Capital, is in fact a fundamental transformation of business from shareholder capitalism to stakeholder capitalism. Just give us a quick précis of how that manifests itself in ways that are really detrimental to the interests of those shareholders in many cases.
Well, when stakeholder capitalism was introduced, when the idea was introduced in the mid-1960s, it was introduced as a practical means by which business owners and business managers could be more successful. The idea is if if you're going to be a successful business operator, then you have to be concerned, in addition to your shareholders, about your employees and your customers and the environment in which you operate. It's simple, basic business common sense. Over the years, though, this has evolved into a new moral, new ethical scheme for business, whereby stakeholders outside of the shareholders take on a much greater moral claim to the work and the profit of the business. And so this is detrimental not only to basic property rights, but to the idea of what a corporation is and how it should function. And over the last probably decade or so, this has become the norm within a great many businesses throughout the West, but especially in the United States, that there is this expectation that corporations function not specifically for the benefit of those who capitalize it, but for the benefit of everyone, for this sort of grand socialized benefit that is easily manipulated.
Yeah, socialized being the operative word, socialized socialism, as the case may be, or fascism of a kind. I mean, this relationship with the state is also very worrying, particularly on the part of some of the people you mentioned a moment ago, Steve Sukup, in the big tech part of the capitalist infrastructure. Let me turn to one quick question for you, maybe a little bit out of the blue, Steve, but it seems such an interesting development. Woke capitalists, in the best sense of the word, in China doing business there, American companies or foreign companies, in this case, a Swedish company called H&M, have recently come under intense pressure from the Chinese Communist Party for having said they're not going to use cotton that has been produced by forced labor in Western China's province known as Xinjiang. In response to H&M having done so, the Chinese have essentially vaporized that company. I mean, it still has a number of outlets, but it's, I think, having a very hard time doing business now. It's essentially been whited out like Trotsky, you know, back in the old Soviet days. To the extent, very quickly, that we're seeing the Chinese using coercive pressure against these capitalists to bend them to their will. What does this say about the prospects for these companies, you know, standing up for human rights and such principles?
Well, I think that this is something that we've understood about the Chinese Communist Party for a long time, that this is their reaction to American companies that dissent. The problem, however, is that most American businessmen believe that they have a secret formula that will help them to tame the CCP and to, you know, bring them to heel. And so they don't treat this as a real phenomenon. They believe that they can do business with the Chinese, whereas somebody else couldn't. And for a long time, I assume H&M believed that as well. And now they've learned that's not the case.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating to watch this play out with their counterparts and others thinking about doing business in China. Steve Sukup, we're out of time. Thank you for yours today, as well as for the great work you've done with this important book, Dictatorship of Woke Capital. And I also commend to all of our listeners, StopCorporateTyranny.org, one of your important new initiatives. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us again soon if you would. Next up, we'll speak to somebody else right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest, a colleague and friend of many years, now a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, where he directs its project on global anti-Semitism and the U.S.-Israel relationship. His name is Dr. David Wormser. He has served with distinction in a number of capacities in the U.S. government, including as a special assistant for the Middle East to then Vice President Dick Cheney. David Wormser, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Well, it's always good to be back, Grant.
You and one of our other colleagues at the Center for Security Policy, Senior Fellow Dr. Victoria Coates, conducted with our colleague Fred Flights, the president of the center, a terrific webinar on the Biden administration's policy towards Iran in the course of the day yesterday. And we telegraphed with the audience some of the things that Victoria was going to say. And I'm very grateful to you for coming aboard to talk a little bit about some of the things you had to say and the overall thrust of this really important panel on what mistakes really the Biden team is making. And we know they're mistakes because they've done them before and it hasn't worked out. Talk with us a little bit about the state of play as you see it now, David, vis-a-vis Iran, as far as the Biden administration is concerned.
Well, I think it's clear now, as it was under the Obama administration, that one of the signal foreign policy efforts is to achieve a deal with Iran, except it had been tried before, it failed, and now we have 4 or 5 years of experience under the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, that showed they never were serious about complying with it. They never came clean at the beginning of it. It was unverifiable, and too many of its activities that were dangerous were not covered by the agreement. But despite that, Iran is completely out of it and galloping forward now in its nuclear program. So the Biden administration is trying to bring it back to the Obama administration's concept, which failed to begin with, and they're redoubling their efforts. I think this is one of their main foreign policy thrusts right now. They've put a stopwatch to this because they've convinced themselves the elections in Iran on June 18th will produce a more tough government there. So they're trying to get it done by then. And essentially, we've entered the bazaar of a negotiation, desperate and with a stopwatch, which is a terrible combination.
Yeah, especially with professional hagglers like the Iranian mullahs. David, I want to come back to the election in a minute because I think that's an important data point for our audience. But before we do, again, the various steps that are being proposed here, whether they're, you know, not insisting on comprehensive inspections, whether they are allowing a whole host of activities that are clearly both underway in Iran and leading inexorably to nuclear weapons capabilities. So I'm thinking in particular of advanced centrifuges, which are busily spinning, processing, enriching uranium. But also this idea that we can induce the Iranians to come to the table by relieving them of at least some of the sanctions that the Trump administration reinstituted preemptively and without some kind of quid pro quo. All of these have been proven failures, have they not? And is there any reason to believe, as Einstein used to say, you'll get a different result if you persist in this kind of insanity?
It is proven that there is a historical record of these attempts, and they are consistently failing. And it will again. And in this case, what we've done is we've given them 2 concessions this week. One, that if they just stop enriching, which means they get it, they never mentioned that they have to give up the highly enriched material that they've done over the last 2-3 months, which of course is very close to the amount you need for a bomb. It's not quite the level you need for a bomb, but it's most of the way there. The second big concession is that the timeline. We had maintained, even under the Biden administration for the first month and a half, that we can't take a first step until Iran comes back into compliance. And then, yes, we'd waive the sanctions and all this money would flow to Iran. But now we've inverted and we've said essentially we don't care who goes first, which implies we will go first. And the truth is we started to. We've already indicated to the South Koreans and others to begin to release their assets, and they have. So Iran is already seeing a money flow develop. This is never in the Middle East, and especially with our experience with Iran, this will be seen in Tehran as weakness and despair and will be treated accordingly.
Unfortunately, that signal is being sent to allies of ours as well. And this is worrying because either they may decide to forge some sort of separate peace with the Iranians, which will be a bad thing, or perhaps they may feel constrained to take action against the Iranians with the United States, possibly interposing objections or even interference to it. I'm thinking particularly of the Iranians. You and Victoria talked about this scenario, and it's very troubling because, as you pointed out, I think it may wind up putting us at odds with our most important regional ally and possibly jeopardize its success of its mission if it feels the need to try to prevent the Iranians from getting nuclear capabilities the old-fashioned way through military force. Talk about that if you would.
Yeah, well, no, absolutely. The Iranians, well, the Israelis right now are beginning to rhetorically at least suggest that they're getting close to maybe taking an action against Iran. The problem here is that under a hostile administration in Washington, which the Biden administration every day seems to be more and more headed toward, you have a number of ways in which you could really compromise the Israeli ability to act. One is to leak information that Israel's planning a strike, something that we might be monitoring, most likely would be monitoring. And it's not inconceivable at all that intelligence officials could leak that. It happened, by the way, under the Bush administration, in the Syria strike, that the some intelligence officials apparently here who were opposed to that strike did leak it. Now, fortunately, the Syrians didn't pick up on it. The Israelis realized the Syrians didn't pick up on it and went ahead anyway with the strike. But you could see that happening again. The second thing is there's a lot of our aircraft are in the air all over the region, and it's very dangerous for Israel to launch a strike at that distance going through territories that we are present in without coordination ahead of time, specifically exchange of IFF codes, those codes that identify friend or foe, and so forth. And so it could sabotage an attack just by lack of coordination.
This is tremendously problematic, I think, on a lot of different levels, especially as we've talked about before, David, and so far as we have a fellow by the name of Mehar Bitar in a key position in the National Security Council, where he is overseeing intelligence. He's a very hostile figure towards Israel and in a position to do precisely what you've talked about, jeopardizing an operation through leaks or other kind of mischief. I really worry about that. But let's come back to this election business, David, because talk about deja vu all over again. How many times have we been told that there's some real difference between the people who are running the government of Iran and the people who might run the government of Iran? The hawks and doves is kind of how it was put back in the old days of the Soviet Union, as you recall, with the Kremlin. Is there any evidence that there's a dime's worth of difference between the so-called moderates like Rouhani and this foreign minister, Jafar, and the hardliners led by the Ayatollah Khamenei? And even if there were a difference, who ultimately calls the shots?
In terms of our interests, there's no difference. I mean, there may be slight differences in terms of believing in the apocalypse, and so forth, imminent apocalypse and so forth. And that can lead to some policy differences, which essentially in our world would translate into the difference between somebody who will pursue an extremely aggressive policy, but lie about it and dissemble and cover it up while still doing it, or somebody who more openly will say, oh, they're weak, let's just do it anyway. But for our point of view, there's no difference.
The purpose is the same. Yeah, their agenda.
The purpose is the same, and Khamenei controls Iran. This idea that anybody else does needs to be dispelled. He calls the shots, even who wins the election.
David, we have to leave it at that, I'm afraid. There's so much more to talk with you about. We'll look forward to doing so next week. Thanks for the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy. And please, folks, check out at securefreedom.org the really insightful webinar that David Wormser, Victoria Coates, and Fred Flights convened yesterday at the Center for Security Policy. Terrific stuff. We'll talk with you again soon, David. We'll talk again with the rest of you, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.